Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Martin Salzberg. He is professor of illustration at Cambridge School of Art in Anglia Ruskin University. And we're talking about his latest book, The Illustrated Dust Jacket, 1920 to 1970. Martin, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking me.
First of all, I want to start right off, and for the benefit of the audience, saying this is a beautiful book about a wonderful subject. The book is beautifully designed, especially the book cover, which so captures the essence of what this book is about.
I'm really pleased you said that. Yes, it's we talked about it so much with the publisher. They're a real pleasure to work with, Thames and Hudson, and we thought, how do we get somebody to design a dust jacket for a book about dust jackets? And Bill Bragg, the artist I spoke to after he did it, just to thank him, he said it made him more nervous than any illustration job he'd ever had.
Now, this is first of all, it's an unusual subject, and people may not have even considered, most of the people listening, dust jackets as an art form, but as your book proves, it's most definitely art form, although today it's not like it was back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
No, I guess, like everything else, it evolves. Although I would say today there's an awful lot of beautiful artwork and design going on, but a lot of it does kind of hark back to those mid-century years. There's a lot of it gets loosely called retro or vintage, but yeah, I think that period's had a big influence on design at the moment across all areas.
Well, let's talk about terminology first so people will understand what we're talking about. When we say dust jackets, is that the same thing as a dust wrapper?
Well, yes, I think so. I think there is some confusion and ambiguity about the terminology. I mean, a dust wrapper, I think, was the original term when it was literally a wrapper against dust, a plain paper wrapping the books, which were mostly sort of beautifully bound in leather and that kind of thing, and it was to keep the dirt off them. But it was only as it began to evolve into something that was designed and decorated and a promotional tool that the kind of jacket, as we call it now, evolved, that slipped on and off easily rather than being wrapped up and then discarded as soon as you bought it.
Do we have a definite date for the first designed dust jacket?
Apparently, yes. So you put me on the spot now. It's it was always thought to be one particular jacket. I can't remember the title of the book now, but it was the first one that was deemed to have kind of just a little bit of decorative floron border on it. And then somebody discovered another one in the Bodleian Museum in Oxford. I think we're talking about the very early 1830s.
Yeah, when printed and designed dust jackets first came out, did people still discard them as they did the original dust wrappers?
Yes, and I mean some people still do, but yeah, I guess it was the habit that it was there to protect the binding. I mean, a colleague of mine at the art school where I teach, who absolutely loves dust jackets, but she very carefully takes them off and saves them in a drawer somewhere else. Everybody has their own relationship with a dust jacket, I think.
But that's why these, in good condition, they're not that common, especially the early ones from the 1910s and 20s.
That's right, yes.
It's very difficult to find them in mint condition.
Yes, and it seems to have become more and more of an issue for book collectors, especially the periods when the paper was very flimsy. It's also the immediate years after the Second World War when there were paper shortages. there were a lot of beautiful sort of neo-romantic designs at that time, but they were all on very, very poor quality paper, so they've become rather prized as well now.
Now, most of the covers, the dust jackets, I think all of them in this book, are American and European. What about dust jacket design in Asia or Africa or South America, for that matter?
Well, I mean, yeah, we were looking at the scope of the book at the start. I mean, I think it is inevitably Anglo-centric, because that's the kind of area that I have most knowledge of, the English language world. But I mean, I did look a lot into the Far East traditions, and it seems to have been less of a far less common phenomenon. They tended to have the, and still do, I think, they have the extended cover that folds inwards, that is actually part of the cover. And the Japanese commonly have a thing that they call the obi, which is like a mini dust jacket. It's like a little band that goes round, and in typical Japanese fashion, it is very, very attractive and sort of sushi-like, but is not actually, doesn't have any kind of protective quality.
Wait, how soon along, once people started designing and artists started working on dust jackets, how soon was it before the dust jacket then became an integral aspect of the hardbound book that, you know, when you think about it now, the dust jacket means everything in sales now. You know, you see an attractive and beautiful dust jacket, that is going to appeal to you, and you're going to buy that book.
Yeah.
Did that catch on right away? Did people really understand the power of the dust jacket?
Certainly not in the early part of the 20th century, no. I mean, people often ask me why I chose 1920 to 1970, and it's not entirely arbitrary. I mean, it was around about 1920 that the use of the jacket as a promotional sort of mini poster started to be recognized and exploited. I mean, there are some earlier than that, but it just seemed to take off about that time. And I think at about 1970 was when photography seemed to really take over from the artist's hand, as it were. We've come back the other way now. Early 20th century, it really took off. But it was very slow to take off, I think.
It's interesting because, as you mentioned in the book, for today's book collectors, the jacket is one of the key elements to the worth of the book.
Yes, it's just become more and more so. it's a strange, yes, sorry, you asked about attitudes to whether the jacket is an integral part of the book, and I think people just disagree about it still. You know, I think some people still see that it is an ephemeral addition. And that the book itself is the key thing. But as you say, for collectors now, a really pristine early first edition jacket, it seems to sort of quadruple the value of the book. It's extraordinary.
How about wraparound designs? Because I happen to love those. And I'm loving them more after your book. I mean, but I've always, I really, it's funny, as I've read your book, I started reflecting on the books I've collected and the books that I find attractive. And I realize these wraparound designs have always fascinated me. Were they attempted right away, or did it take time for people to design these wraparounds?
No, I think that was slower to catch on. It's possibly to do with just the way books are stacked in bookshops. Perhaps it was not seen as worth the extra effort or expense at that stage, but certainly in the mid-century it became more and more common. I think from the designer's perspective, I mean it's a lovely challenge to do a wraparound jacket, but it's an interesting one because you have to, of course, make one functioning complete design, but the front part has to work independently of the rest very clearly. The spine has to work, has to be readable for being seen just on its own. And the back has to usually accommodate various bits of extra typographic information. I always think I don't know if you noticed the designers, Clifford and Mary Ellis.
Oh, yes.
Who did the new Naturalist series.
And that's, by the way, that's still a well-designed series as far as the covers are going.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So they had particular care in designing the spine as a something that had to appeal on its own. So often that they would be arranged with only the spine visible.
It's really interesting because when you line the books up on your shelf and you're only seeing the spines, that series sticks out as beautifully designed.
Yes, yes, they're exquisite and very, very much collected, I think. Now, I'm not a real book collector myself. I collect an enormous number of books, but not in the sense of those who are out and out collectors of particular series or whatever. But it's interesting that the new Naturalist series with the Ellis covers, they all have different values. There are ones that were obviously printed in a very small print run and didn't sell very well, and weren't reprinted, so they're terribly scarce. And I think one called the Folklore of Birds, which it just seemed to be. It's got a beautiful cover of the barn owl flying towards you in a sort of mystical way. But it seemed to be slightly outside of the remit, really. It's not really about the natural world. It's more about the folklore connected to it.
Now, how were these designs arrived at from a publishing house? How much leeway did an artist have? Were they just assigned what it should be looked at? How were decisions made?
Well, I think I'm guessing that it's always been the case, certainly the case now, that different publishers work in different ways. And I've written quite a bit about John Layman,
the
publisher, in the mid-century years, or the post-war years, who commissioned wonderful artists and made some beautiful books. And he had a particularly light touch in terms of any kind of direction. He would trust the artist to come up with ideas and give them as few constraints as possible. But of course, usually the artist would have to come up with a set of roughs, and if the publisher, art editor, designer really find fault with it, they would ask them to revise them. My feeling is that the best work comes from a commissioner choosing an artist that they feel is exactly right for the tone of the text, and as much as possible letting them get on with it.
Yeah, and some of the artists actually designed their own typography too for the cover.
Yes, a lot of which has come back into fashion again now. A lot of integrated hand lettering. Again, especially in the mid-century, with people like John Minton and Edward Borden. Yeah. I think they really are some of the loveliest jackets now.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Martin Salisbury. He is professor of illustration at Cambridge School of Art in Anglia, Ruskin University, and we're talking about his latest book. It's a beautiful, gorgeous book, but it'll really get you excited. It's like I said, for me, it was like discovering a whole new art history. But despite that, some very famous artists or people known in other graphic fields were great book designers, dust jacket designers, and you have them in this book. And it's fascinating to look at the designs of somebody like Rockwell Kent.
I mean, he's an interesting one. I must confess, I didn't know so much about him before I was researching the book, and I found him absolutely fascinating in terms of as a character and his kind of political interests and all the rest of it. But his designs were just so theatrical. There are one or two beautiful ones. I think it's called Mountain Meadow, the Buchan.
Oh yeah.
One.
It's a wraparound.
Yes, complete wraparound, and it's theatrical, and it has sort of hints of a kind of almost sort of Soviet heroic postures and things. But yes, he must have seemed very unusual in his time, I think.
Now, did dust jacket design and artwork, it must have followed the same trends that were going on in visual arts at the time?
by and large, yes. I mean, that's another very interesting aspect of it. I suppose you could say that most of the visual arts, the applied arts, have over the years tended to mirror the general trends. But I think in the past, there was more connection between the applied arts and the fine arts. Now, of course, certainly here in the UK, I think what are called the fine arts have become so conceptual rather than pictorial that they're probably further apart than they've ever been. But some of the British artists, like John Piper, Keith Vaughan, who were primarily painters, actually had no problem at all in the mid-century working across the commercial arts as well, which is something I just think is wonderful. I think it is coming back a little bit, but it's more across the sort of craft side of things, I think.
It's interesting because you mentioned with the dust jacket design, the kitchen sink period in Britain, yeah. Which goes from like 1950s through to the 60s. First thing I thought of was the kitchen sink style of realist films that came out of Britain at that time, like The Loneliest of the Long Distance Runner and so on and so forth. And that perfectly matched the style of graphic art that were in dust jackets at that time.
Yeah, so it's just kind of a zeitgeist, isn't it? I mean, it was the period when suddenly the lives of the working classes were being dealt with in literature and film. I mean, sometimes it was usually the film of the book, but sometimes it was just filmmaking. But yeah, it was a sort of gritty, slightly bleak kind of feel to a lot of the work, pensive and dark.
Now, let's talk about individual artists, and I'm going to have to skip around. There's too many artists in this book, but I just want to mention a few that really, and one of the problems with this, your book, by the way, is there's a lot of books I hadn't read yet that I saw the dust jackets of, and now I feel like compelled that I have to read those books.
It's not always the case that the book itself lives up to the dust jacket, obviously. I don't know if you remember, there was an anecdote from the son of, I can't remember, one of the US artists, Hawkins.
Yep.
Who bumped into a bookseller in a shop. He was looking for his father's jackets, and the bookseller said, when he introduced himself as the son of Arthur Hawkins, the bookseller said, your father is responsible for me buying more books that turned out to be rubbish than I could imagine.
I can't believe it. Well, there's in some cases, there's an entire series. There's an artist, Tove Jansson, from Finland. I had never even heard of that entire series, the Moominland series.
Really? Well, over here in
Europe, I don't know if they ever made it over here to the United States.
Oh, that's interesting to know. I thought she was pretty universal, but I mean, it is very she's a writer as well as an artist, and she's very Scandinavian somehow. So maybe it doesn't travel. I mean, it somehow took off in the UK, but whether it's all over the rest of the world, I don't know. Beautiful writer. I would recommend a little book called The Summer House, I think it's called. It's just recollections of childhood spent on a little island off Finland with her grandmother.
Some of the artists, I had read their book, but was surprised to find out that they were a graphic artist as well. Like, a good example is Mervyn Peake, who I read the Gormenghast trilogy, and I was surprised to find out that he was a graphic artist who designed quite a number of dust jackets.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Peake, again, over here, is probably as well known for his visual work as for his writing. I mean, he's quite unusual in that way, in that he was very much both things and illustrated all of his own work. It's a sign of how old I'm getting. A very close friend of mine, an illustrator who's now in his 80s, was taught by Peake at the Central School of Arts in London in the 1950s, but Peake was already, I think he suffered from Parkinson's disease or something, so he was already quite unwell. But it's extraordinary to be able to hear those first-hand stories of some of these artists.
Some of them are just totally unique. And I'm going to mispronounce this name, Boris Artsabashev.
Well, I'm afraid it's a case of your guess is as good as mine.
I was familiar with his wild illustrations, but I never thought that would translate well into a dust jacket to sell a book.
No, I don't think he did too many, but they are just completely unique, aren't they? I would almost say they're sort of slightly bonkers.
I think that's an understatement.
He did work mainly in the States, I think. He came over from Russia, I think he's pretty well known.
Now,
it's interesting how he recycles some of the little motifs, and you see them pop up in different jackets,
like the hands with the eyeballs.
Yeah, exactly.
Pop up and stuff. Now, some of the dust jacket designs for me were just so gorgeous, and they really capture a mood and a feeling. Brian Cook, who did the dust jackets for a whole series of books about the old inns of England, the cathedrals of England. He didn't write the books; he just designed the parish churches and so on and so forth. They're wraparound.
Well, he did write some of them under pseudonyms. He was later known as Brian Batsford because he married into the Batsford publishing family. But there were only two or three of them actually producing these books, and they made up different names. travel around the country visiting all of these various places and making drawings. But he did definitely write some of them.
The look of those covers, though, those dust jackets, they look screen printed.
Yes, and in the past I always thought they were screen printed. It's very strange. They're hand painted in gouache in flat sort of blocks of colour to look like a flat printing. And they're also printed by this fancy name for a particular print process called the Jean Bertet process, which is really, I think, just a fancy name for water-based inks. They're very common books. You find them all over the place, but you very rarely find one in nice condition because these water-based inks just rub off and fade so badly.
Vanessa Bell, really interesting art style. First of all, she's Virginia Woolf's sister.
That's right.
And actually did the dust jackets for several of her sister's books.
Yes, a lot of them.
Sort of verge into the entirely abstract.
Yes, and really quite crude. And as I mentioned in the book, she was a very good painter. But when these first appeared in the shops, apparently, they just didn't look like anything else at all. They do look very, very handmade. It's a sort of kitchen table aesthetic. And actually, they were. The original Hogarth Press books were actually printed on the kitchen table, literally, and when they first set up. So I think I gather that the booksellers hated them and they were sort of ridiculed by a lot of people, but they just would have stood out, I suppose, and been instantly recognizable.
Now, an artist from here in Massachusetts, Edward Gorey, people are very familiar with his set designs, with his illustrated books, but he also did a number of dust jackets, including for novels like Thomas Wolfe's You Can't Go Home Again.
Huge number, actually, because in his early working years, he was actually in a full-time job at a publishing house as a designer, illustrator, and commissioner, I think. He was a very literary man and a unique artist. I suppose you could almost compare him to Mervyn Peake in a way, not stylistically, but in that there's something just totally unique about his way of working. After he'd worked designing book jackets day after day, he eventually was published himself and went on to become the fabulously eccentric creator that we know and love.
And he did a version, he did the dust jacket and the interior illustrations for a version of War of the Worlds.
He did.
which yes, I didn't. I never knew that. And it looks, when you look at it, it looks very gory.
It does. I mean, I think his work is always instantly recognizable, really. Even when he's working for all this wide range of texts. I mean, War of the Worlds, I'm just looking at it now, actually. It's a very unusual subject for him, but it's just gory.
And there are artists who you instantaneously recognize their style. And for me, it sort of brings a smile to my face. Ronald Searle. I know you guys in Britain are up to your armpits in Ronald Searle's work, but here, you know, I love his work, and I love the Saint Trinian series and stuff like that. But to see his dust jacket designs are great. I love seeing those.
Yes. Well, it's lovely to be able to talk about Ronald Searle because I got to know him in his later years. He was a student at Cambridge School of Art, where I'm based. Just before the outbreak of the Second World War, and he was born and brought up in Cambridge, and his studies were cut short by the outbreak of war. And of course, as a lot of people know, he was in the Japanese prisoner of war camp for most of the war. Did some amazing drawings on there, on every scrap of paper he could find. But I travelled to visit him in his home in France in his later years and took him an honorary doctorate from our university.
Oh, wow.
And it was an enormous thrill to meet him, and we talked and talked, and I recorded a long interview with him. But, yeah, I mean, he designed the jackets for his own books, of course, and he set up his own publishing company for a while called Perpetua. And they have quite a distinctive look to them, all hand-lettered and with a little hand-designed colophon. Wonderful man.
Yes. Well, we're completely out of time, and we could talk about this book for hours. My guest tonight is Martin Salisbury. He is professor of illustration at Cambridge School of Art and Anglia Ruskin University, and we're talking about his latest book. Boy, it's a beautiful book, but it also makes you want to read the books that are illustrated. The Illustrated Dust Jacket, 1920 to 1970. Martin, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been a joy to exchange notes, as it were.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.